Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Nikki Ouellette. Coming up, two conservative women started with similar beliefs about abortion. Then they got pregnant, and their beliefs shifted.
I'm an abortion advocate, something I never thought that I would ever be.
We hear from a nonprofit that tracks federal election spending. They found Wyoming's D.C. hopefuls get almost all of their campaign funding from out of state.
All that to be said, I do think it's up to Wyoming to decide if this is okay or not.
And we'll join a conversation exploring some of our misguided stereotypes about rural America.
In my mind, whatever power rural populations get from our electoral systems isn't bearing fruit.
Those stories and more, stay with us. This is Open Spaces.
This time on The Modern West. It's been a year since a man brought an injured wolf into a bar in Sublette County. What does it tell us about how small-town life is changing?
Boys and boobs and wolves obviously didn't mix up well, all right? What was wrong about it was bringing it to this damn bar.
Boys, booze, and wolves. It's part three of The Gray in Between. Find it under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Nikki Ouellette. Beliefs about whether abortion should be legal are deeply entrenched. As restrictions are being challenged in courts across our region, Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Merzbach sat down with two women whose pregnancies led them to opposite perspectives.
Marty Halverson sits in the community center in her 2-square-mile community of Etna in western Wyoming. She's sporting a silver bob with a fringe of bangs and a black vest with a distinct gold pin on it.
It says GOP.
She's been a Republican since her father gave the information for her birth certificate.
He said, yeah, boy, girl, where do I put Republican?
Hanging from the pin is a pair of tiny gold feet.
We wear this to remind ourselves that these perfectly formed feet are 10 weeks after conception.
The leader of advocacy group Wyoming Right to Life and a former state lawmaker, she wasn't always such a staunch abortion opponent.
It was in 1973 that I first got pregnant. I was 21.
She and her husband hadn't planned to start a family for a couple years.
But accidents happen. And my doctor gleefully informed me that I could have an abortion. I had to ask her, what is an abortion?
Just a few months earlier, the U.S. Supreme Court had recognized women's right to an abortion in the landmark Roe v. Wade decision.
And when she explained it to me, I was mortified. Even though our baby wasn't planned, it was a baby, and killing it was out of the question. So I quickly found another doctor and went through my pregnancy.
She shuffles through a stack of pamphlets and studies which support her beliefs. She says her faith, Christian, has nothing to do with her opposition to abortion.
It is science-driven. Life begins at conception.
But that's something Wyomingites are debating. Abortion remains legal in the state, but the Wyoming Supreme Court is considering if the government can ban the practice in most cases. It's one of many states, including Utah and Idaho, where abortion access has been reconsidered after Roe was overturned 3 years ago. Another Wyoming resident, Riotta Little Walker, used to be opposed to abortion.
I would have always said that I was pro-life with exceptions for rape, incest, and danger to the mother.
Walker sits cross-legged on her brown leather sectional on the east side of the state in Casper. She says she was raised Catholic and conservative. Then in 2019, she and her husband were pregnant with their first daughter, and they got a call from their doctor.
And she said, you're now high risk.
She just had a 21-week scan.
She had heart defects. We were told, if you make it to term, and if she survives birth, then she'll have a very complex existence. Really hit me that, oh my gosh, she's never leaving a hospital.
Then the young couple was given the same option as Halverson.
ultimately, we made the decision based off of her heart. She did not deserve to suffer and die in a painful way.
So Walker decided to have an abortion and induce labor early.
And I held her in her final few minutes of her life.
She now has two healthy kids, aged 4 and 1, but keeps her first daughter close in a little bronze heart urn.
Google AI says that I am an abortion advocate, something I never thought that I would ever be. But in my mind, this is my daughter's legacy. If some people should have the right to make that choice, then everyone needs to be able to make that choice. And so now I say I err on the side of freedom.
And for Halverson, the issue is also about freedom.
What about the freedom of the baby? What about the freedom for that life?
Wyoming justices have until late summer to make a decision on the state's abortion bans. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Hannah Merzbach.
Do you know how much money your congressional candidate receives from out-of-state sources? According to a new report by the campaign finance tracker and D.C.-based nonprofit Open Secrets, it's quite a lot. A recent study by Open Secrets found that in states with smaller populations, like Wyoming, political funds flow from the outside in, and it's been getting more pronounced. Wyoming Public Radio's Jordan Uplinger spoke with Hillary Brasseth, the executive director of Open Secrets, about this trend.
You just wrapped up a review of how congressional campaigns are funded, and you found that the share of money candidates raise from their own constituents was the second lowest on record. What did you pull from your study?
So we looked at essentially all of our contribution data across, federal candidates for members of Congress, whether that's the House and the Senate, versus outside of state. And we looked at those figures over the last a little more than a decade, so since 2012, and noticed that there's been a steady rate of decline. And save for historic lows in 2020, which I think probably could be attributed largely to the pandemic, last year continues to show this sort of steady downward trend in terms of how much money a candidate is getting inside the district versus outside the district.
I'm curious if the study was able to kind of parse through the data and find if individuals, families were sending donations out of state to other congressional candidates as well, or if this is primarily large sums of money crossing state lines, you know, from a firm or a richer individual, let's say.
That's actually an addendum that we hope to build on this study for, is examining what type of money that is. Is it small donations, i.e. classified as sub $200, typically from the individual or, you know, family, or were they really big dollar donations, typically funneled through the vehicle of a super PAC that tends to collect money from anywhere from corporations to nonprofits to individuals in large sums and then distributes that across candidates. That's the second phase of this analysis that we hope to build on.
And we will definitely be touching on super PACs later, as they're a very key part of this whole thing as well. But to bring it back home here, in your report, you said smaller states like Vermont and Wyoming, as two examples, rely on out-of-state donations. In Wyoming, 89% of House fundraising was out of state. In the Senate, 92.5% was out of state. So why is that? And how does that reliance kind of impact state politics?
Those are some pretty staggering figures, if you really think about it, that, you know, around 10% or less of a candidate's money is coming from within the state of Wyoming. And, you know, is this typical? I think one of the reasons that we tend to see this happening is that in states with lower population numbers, like Wyoming, where there's only one House candidate, we see a lot more outside money or outside state money coming into those cycles. You could come up with a number of theories for why that might be the case. Potentially, that means that you could have greater influence because there are fewer other votes happening within that state to represent the state. And so there might be more interest from out-of-state folks in wanting to build relationship via giving a donation to those candidates.
Open Secrets reported that Representative Harriet Hageman has received $15,000 from the American Israel Public Affairs Committee. Senator John Barrasso has received over $70,000 from a private equity firm based in New York and California. And Senator Cynthia Lummis has received almost $140,000 from the Club for Growth, a conservative PAC. In the face of more powerful organizations like those, how do individuals or local donors in Wyoming make their voice more impactful or their donation more impactful?
What allows somebody to be elected is votes, right? So I think if nothing else, our perspective as an organization that follows the money in politics is, and makes that very easily accessible on our website, is ideally for Americans to use that information to inform themselves about the sources of funding for any candidate that goes before them on the ballot. And so if Wyoming citizens don't love that Wyoming candidates get their money from outside of state and make that known by virtue of their vote, by all means, that absolutely could have a mark to bear on, you know, the strategy going forward of any candidates who decide to run for office.
We're now 15 years past the landmark Supreme Court case, Citizens United versus FEC, a case which allowed for corporate, union, nonprofit money to kind of flow into political action committees. How has this changed politics over the last decade?
So let me just paint a little bit of a picture here. The total cost of the 2000 elections, presidential and congressional combined, was around $3.1 billion. 12 years later in 2012, just three presidential cycles later, and the first presidential election cycle after the landmark Citizens United case, as you mentioned, that doubled to $6.3 billion. Then just two presidential cycles later in 2020, so we leap from 2012 to 2020, that figure again more than doubled to $15.2 billion. And then last year, we're punching in right about, if not above, that same total cost of the elections, presidential and congressional combined. So it is undeniably drastic in terms of the flow of capital into our election cycle. And a lot of that is through that vehicle that you just mentioned, the Super PAC, which essentially paves the way for corporations, unions, nonprofits, individuals to spend unlimited sums of money on elections. And if you look at the number of $1 million plus donations since before Citizens United, it's also exponential growth. So what we're seeing is not only is there more money, but there's more money from fewer individuals who are giving these really large sums of money through the vehicle largely of the Super PAC.
If Wyoming now is a state that sees a lot of money from outside the state, do you expect that trend to continue? And should voters in Wyoming feel excited that their state is getting so much attention, that so many people want to be a part of the conversation at the Wyoming table? Or should they be a little concerned that so many people want to be a part of the conversation at the Wyoming table, even though they weren't there to begin with?
Based on the figures that we've seen and the trends over the last decade plus, it's likely that we see those figures continue to increase in terms of money coming from out of state versus in state. All that to be said, I do think it's up to Wyoming to decide if this is okay or not. And if they're not okay with it, there's policy pathways. And if they are okay with it, then I think that there still needs to be transparency on where the money's coming from for the sake of trust and integrity and democracy.
That was Hillary Brasseth with the campaign finance tracker Open Secrets, speaking about the trend of outside funding in Wyoming's congressional elections with Wyoming Public Radio's Jordan Uplinger. The Trump administration's crackdown on immigration has some international students nervous about their future in America. That's up next on Open Spaces.
Hi, I'm Grady Kirkpatrick, inviting you to join me for Wyoming Sounds. Along with your favorites, you'll discover plenty of new music. We bring you NPR news updates, weather, and we'll let you know about events happening around Wyoming. Wyoming Sounds from 9 to noon on Wyoming Public Radio and 24/7 online at wyomingsounds.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. International students at the University of Wyoming face mounting uncertainty about their future in the United States as the Trump administration carries out its hardline immigration policies. Six students recently saw their visa records deleted without warning, then reinstated. International students are afraid to speak publicly, and the offices that serve them have turned down interview requests. But Abdul Rahim Abuarda, one of UW's more than 600 international students, has been outspoken about his life on campus. He says his student visa is a lifeline for him, his wife, and their three children as the Israel-Hamas war rages back home.
My name is Abdulrahim Abu Arda. I am originally from Gaza, from Palestine, and I came here to the University of Wyoming 3 years ago to do my Master in International Studies. And I recently started doing my PhD here as well at UW in Public Humanities in the English department. And I have a family here that came to Wyoming last year. I came to Wyoming by myself. I was part of the Fulbright Scholarship to do my master, and one of their policies is that as a Palestinian, I'm not allowed to bring my dependents to the United States. So they stayed there in Gaza. Like, I did my master for the whole 2 years without them, and then recently they came here, and my wife is doing her master in international studies here. That's how she was able to come to the U.S., by getting a graduate assistantship here, and then she brought the kids with her. The first 2 years here, they were very difficult because I did not have them around. Of course, like, the people here, like in Laramie, the community were amazing. My friends and colleagues and professors and teachers, everyone has been always supportive, and they understood my situation, especially when the war on Gaza started. Like, they were very, very supportive, and they would contact me and talk to me on a daily basis, and some of my friends would even make me food. It was really difficult for me because my family was still in Gaza during the war, and they were not able to get out of Gaza. And then eventually, with the help of people from here, from Laramie and the U.S., I managed to get them out to Egypt, to evacuate them to Egypt. And you have to pay a bribe to the Egyptian authorities. And before the war, like, the bribe was like $1,000 for an individual. But during the war, it became like $5,000 for an individual. So I have my wife and three kids. So actually, we paid more than we were supposed to. We got them to Egypt, and then my wife started applying for scholarships here and programs here. And finally, she got accepted, and she came to the U.S. It's a huge relief because, like, you know, there's this constant fear that something is going to happen to them. My kids were not doing well when they were in Gaza, like, because of the lack of food and water and, like, health. So my youngest daughter had cholera. We were scared that something is going to happen to her. I contacted a lot of my friends here in Wyoming and in the U.S., and they helped me secure the money and get them to Egypt. No, she's fine. She gained a lot of weight. She plays all the time. She's having the best times of her life here in Wyoming. Yeah, actually, my three kids are having a lot of fun here in Wyoming. My oldest goes to school. He's an Indian paintbrush, and he loves it so much. He loves his friend, and he's building a community around himself. He knew nothing in the English language, but luckily the school was amazing, and they assigned an English language learning specialist for him, and she helped him a lot acquiring the language, and now he communicates, and he has a friend, and, like, he goes to their birthday parties, and they come to his birthday party, and he has a lot of fun. When they were in Gaza, like, they were deprived of almost everything, like the house. They were constantly moving from one place to another, from one shelter to another, from one school to another, from one tent to another, and there was no food, no clean water, no electricity, of course, no TV, nothing. My oldest was in school. Well, he was in the first grade, and then the war started, and he stopped. So he missed the whole year. He's supposed to be in the second grade. So he missed a grade, and now when he came to the U.S., he started from the first grade. But at least, like, he's back to school. Yeah, here it's way, way better for my kids and for my family. Luckily, all of our documents are legal, everything is okay. Like, we have the visas, we have the DS-19s and the I-20s. Like, these are the documents, the permits to stay in the U.S. So we have everything, like, covered from that angle. Like, yeah. Because even, like, before the new administration came to office, I was making sure that I don't miss anything with my legal status. I'm scared. I'm not only worried. Like, I just told you how life was in Gaza, and now how life is for me and my family in the U.S. It's kind of stable. I'm doing my PhD. My wife is doing her master. This will help us in the future to secure decent jobs. My kids go to school. They have friends. Like, we have, like, we have a life here. Wyoming is our home. The U.S. is our home now. So imagine after this kind of stability, going back to zero. And for us as Palestinians, it's way more worse than other countries because we don't have a country to go back to. So is it gonna be detention? So imagine, like, for me, a father and my wife, something happens to us, like, what is gonna happen to our kids? So it's like a constant fear for me and my wife. Like, every single day we think of that. And sometimes we even think of leaving the country. But it's not an easy option, like, to leave. Where to go? Like, to go to Canada? Now, like, things are not that promising in Canada. And with this administration, to go to Europe, it's not an easy thing. So, yeah, it's terrifying. This administration, like, is very focused on the whole immigration thing. But in the same time, like, I'm a decent citizen here in the U.S. I have never done anything wrong. I'm building a community around me, and I'm immersing in the culture. I love the American culture. I love the American people. I love the people here in Wyoming and in Laramie especially. I built a huge community around me. I'm paying my taxes. I'm doing everything according to the book. And in the same time, I'm living in this constant fear. So this is what I want to say. Like, it's unfair to me and to everyone like me to suffer and struggle from this. People here in Laramie are amazing, and they have been very helpful to me and to my family and to other, like, minorities and immigrants. Like, I like this about this community. It's a small community where, like, you feel you are visible and everyone can see you, and they are willing to help.
Was international UW student Abdelrahim Abuarda. This story was produced by Jeff Victor. The administration's crackdown is also expected to affect harvests. Over 300,000 visas were issued last year to foreign farm workers. It's just a fraction of what the agriculture industry needs for its labor force. As the Mountain West News Bureau Yvette Fernandez reports, labor and industry critics have long wanted to overhaul the country's guest worker program.
This farm worker is picking and bundling radishes while on her knees. Her pay is partly tied to how quickly she works.
This is skilled work. It's very hard work.
Areli Arteaga Sanders is with the United Farm Workers Union. She used to work like this in the fields of Idaho. They are part of an insecure system where 42% of laborers have no work authorization, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
We lost 140,000 farms in 5 years.
That's the American Farm Bureau Federation's Director of Government Affairs, John Walt Boatwright. While tariffs are a concern for farmers, their big concern is their workforce.
Labor is at the top of that list.
President Trump has ramped up deportations with a focus on removing those who entered the country illegally. Fears are of concern to farmers and workers alike. This has some taking a new look at the agricultural worker program known as the H-2A. It issues guest worker visas for several months at a time. For decades, it has had many critics who cite a number of frustrations, from its complicated process to numerous costs and its lack of pathway to citizenship. Both workers and farmers have repeatedly called for an overhaul.
We've gone to Congress with each new Congress and said, we are floundering out here in terms of the ability to continue to produce a safe and abundant food supply.
By itself, the program doesn't create enough workers for the country's farms. That's despite the fact that H-2A visas have grown dramatically from tens of thousands 2 decades ago to hundreds of thousands today.
We're also going to work with farmers.
President Trump at an April cabinet meeting.
They'll go out, they're going to come back as legal workers.
Those remarks were vague and left farm workers questioning if they leave, whether they'll be able to return. Maria Lourdes works in Wiggins, Colorado, about an hour drive from the Denver metro area. Recently, she's been picking onions and, like many farm workers, according to the Labor Department, has more than a decade of experience. She has 2 decades in the fields. She used to spend 6 months of the year doing this kind of work. Now she only does about 1.5 months. Increasingly, she says H-2A guest workers have replaced her. Arteaga Sanders says it's a trend she's noticed.
Her salary yearly went from about $25,000 a year down to about $15,000.
An experienced farm worker who became a U.S. citizen sued and won his case against a California farm. He had alleged he was discriminated against as a citizen when the farm employed guest workers instead. Boatwright says that shouldn't be happening.
If a farmer or an H-2A employer has a domestic worker that approaches the farm and wants to work, that farmer has to employ that worker.
Farm workers have long fought to be appreciated for the work they do. In the 1960s and 70s, the United Farm Workers Union staged a multi-year boycott against grape growers, which resulted in some improvements in wages and working conditions. More reforms took place in the 1980s with the Immigration Reform and Control Act. Additional proposals have languished since then.
Our farm workforce is critical to the success of American agriculture.
Amid Trump's immigration crackdowns and hopes for a more steady workforce, farmers' crops do not wait. For Maria Lourdes, an H-2A visa is not an option. Her status prevents her from obtaining one. Guest workers aren't experienced workers, ones like her, considered essential during the pandemic. Now she and her colleagues are, quote, back in the shadows. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Yvette Fernandez.
Coming up, federal cuts are also trickling down to county health departments. We'll hear about impacts in Wyoming. This is Open Spaces.
Sometimes the news can be a little hard, but Around Wyoming is here to bring you the lighter side of things. Ever heard of frozen chicken curling? Or do you know how many of our residents compete in and win national competitions? Hint, it's a lot. Around Wyoming brings you that and more 4 times every weekday. You can also find Around Wyoming on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio. I'm Nikki Ouellette. Back in March, the Trump administration announced sweeping cuts to the Department of Health and Human Services. The impact at the state level came soon after, about a $40 million loss to the Cowboy State's federal health grants. This directly impacts 2 programs in Teton County. Jackson Hole Community Radio's Jenna McMurtry talked to a health worker in each program to get a better idea of what services will be lost and who, if anyone, will fill the gap.
Every Monday from noon to 4 p.m., the Community Health Outreach Workers Program holds office hours in a study room at the Jackson Library. The child workers, as they're known, mostly help those who come in asking for help with Medicaid applications. But sometimes, CHOW helps people apply for scholarships that get them out of thousands of dollars of healthcare-related debt. Reed Carlman is one of the 3 CHOW workers.
Nobody in the community does Spanish-speaking Medicaid help.
He spent every week since December poring over paperwork and serving as a Spanish-speaking liaison for the program, which serves a clientele where English is often a second language. As of June 10th, the program will no longer exist. Alyssa Gramling works in the county's vaccine clinic, which also received COVID-era grants. That program was slated to end this June, but got cut in March. Gramling says that program filled a gap and helped what she says was an understaffed vaccine clinic. Vaccines eventually went beyond COVID-19.
Teton County always had kind of a need in the realm of communicable diseases and some holes that weren't always totally filled through the normal budget. And so through this grant, we were able to have staff available to help, like, with rabies initiatives and measles initiatives.
Seven measles cases recently cropped up in Gallatin County, just across the Montana state border north of Yellowstone National Park. As the risk of a measles outbreak persists for Teton County, Grambling thinks the department could have benefited from the expansion. Carlin says the prevention-based approach went to the underlying sources of poor health.
The premise of that grant is that COVID-19 revealed underlying health inequities that were really, really deadly, essentially. Just like incredibly impactful on people's lives.
In the United States, non-white Americans have shorter life expectancies, are less likely to have health insurance, and more likely to die from COVID-19. In rural areas, those disparities are often more pronounced. Carlman says Chow helps with applications with the hospital or its foundation and helps remove barriers to healthcare.
Since December 2024, we have at least put down the information, like callback information for 81 people through the program. Different numbers say like 300 since 2023, which I think is a pretty significant undercount.
The high attendance prompted the health department to double up on Chow sessions until the last of the funding dries up and the program ends in June. Because of the Trump administration's latest healthcare cuts, that program is now ending a year ahead of schedule.
I believed that the money had already been allocated. It didn't make sense to me that you could like pull back money that you'd already agreed to spend.
That suddenness was what stood out to Jody Pond, Teton County Commissioner's interim administrator and former public health department director. She was in public health for 35 years.
And I've lived through many, many downturns in the economy that have affected public health. At least we were given notice in previous downturns to wind things down.
Pond says the move reflects a contraction that will be felt years into the future.
The short-sightedness of being able to help people find care now instead of waiting until it costs the system more money. It's the typical prevention is not valued in our society.
For KHOL News, I'm Jenna McMurtry.
We just heard how Teton County has been affected by recent federal cuts to health funding. I want to bring in our reporter, Indy Kara, who's also been reaching out to other counties and the state. Indy, what have you found out?
Yeah, so I've been chatting with Natrona County, and similar to Teton County, their COVID-19 vaccine grant was terminated a few months early, and they were using that to buy supplies and pay staff who worked at fall COVID vaccination clinics. And just this spring, actually, Natrona County had signed a contract for two community health outreach workers, and that grant was terminated. They had their initial hiring offers revoked.
So pretty similar to Teton. I'm curious about the scale of these cuts, like at the state level. Where are they coming from and how is that trickling down?
Yeah, so this sort of started with the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. They cut roughly $12 billion in public health grant funding to states back in March. And in Wyoming, that amount is looking like about $40 million. The Wyoming Department of Health said that 39 million of those are coming from the public health division, and 1 million is coming from their behavioral health division. And this affects a lot of county health departments who receive federal funding through the state health department. But the Wyoming Department of Health has not really provided more information than that. So the exact impacts, other than, you know, what I can learn from the few departments who have been willing to chat with me, still remain pretty unknown.
Got it. So it sounds like some COVID grants have been impacted. What else?
Yes. So like you said, you know, the COVID-19 vaccination grants were a big one that was affected. They supported all things vaccine. And then, like we heard in the story, the community health programs, which were actually using federal COVID-19 dollars to support these outreach workers. There is a big list of HHS grants that were cut, and you can see that Wyoming also had a substance use block grant terminated, which basically helps communities implement activities that prevent and treat substance use.
You know, looking ahead, there's a lot going on. What should we be paying attention to?
Yeah, so the impact, I think, is really concentrated in this round of cuts in county health departments because, you know, like we said, the grants that were affected were being administered through the Wyoming Department of Health to these county departments. But one thing that I think people are watching is the federal budget and proposed cuts to Medicaid, which could have serious implications for Wyoming.
I also spoke to someone who mentioned proposed changes in federal funding for HIV prevention programs, which could have impact on Wyoming clinics that work in this area. But most of what I'm hearing is that it's a lot of waiting and watching to see what comes next and to see how some of these executive orders actually end up getting implemented.
Indy Kara, thank you so much for sharing your reporting.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tony Mong is a wildlife biologist, but he also describes himself as a wildlife biographer. In recent years, he's been sharing the story of mule deer by chronicling their migration journey. He's captured video and other data points that tell us more about the day in the life of a mule deer and the challenges they face navigating rugged terrain and development in the Cody area. Mong spoke with Wyoming Public Radio's Olivia Wheats. They started with Mong describing the journey some mule deer in the Cody area are now making as they head to their summer habitat in Yellowstone.
These mule deer travel across some of the most rugged, difficult terrain there is in the lower 48, some of the most remote places there are in the lower 48. And so that's all coupled on top of, you know, 75 to 80 miles of this. If we think about a mule deer that leaves winter range, a lot of times we just imagine a deer taking a walk, right, and moving from one place to another, going from winter range to summer range. But in that time, the female mule deer are very heavy with a fawn. They take off on their journey and they start climbing these peaks and losing elevation. So they've got this elevation gain and loss of about 25,000 feet. And then on top of that, some of the rivers that they're crossing during this time in late May and early June are at their most swollen that they're going to be from the snowmelt from the mountains. And so they're swimming across these rivers, heavy with fawns, tired from climbing and losing elevation. And then on top of that, there's predators out there that are looking to fill their bellies and also feed their families as well.
So you've been gathering some video data, looking at the day in the life of the mule deer along this journey, seeing kind of what they're seeing through their eyes. What can we really see in these videos that you've been gathering?
But we also have a lot of trail camera videos that are really interesting as far as what we're seeing out on the migration trails. And you would think just taking pictures in the middle of the woods, you wouldn't get much. But what's really awesome is that we're seeing these animals move on the migration routes, crossing logs and log jams and things that they've got to navigate there. We're seeing how difficult it is because on a lot of our cameras, their mouths are wide open and their tongues are sticking out and they're breathing as hard as they can. We've also even captured like these moments where you see a mule deer and behind the mule deer, you see some type of large carnivore that is in the same area and you see that interaction. We've seen them on cameras traveling with elk. We've seen them traveling with other mule deer. Some of the places that they go to have their fawns are amazing. We had one of our does that had a video collar on that migrated up and just outside of Yellowstone National Park. She had found a cave in which to have a fawn. Many of us would pay thousands of dollars to get to this place because it's just fantastic. You see forever, you see the mountains, but we got to actually see and experience kind of a little part of that life of having a fawn. In one video, we saw kind of her breathing start to pick up. And then in the next video, we actually saw her licking the brand new fawn, and which just is an amazing thing.
Yeah, is there any other obstacles? I mean, I'm just thinking about like physical obstacles. I know there's a lot more development, houses, roads, et cetera, in and around Yellowstone.
Sure. So the way I like to think about that is taking kind of the mindset of a fawn that leaves the vastness of Yellowstone National Park or Grand Teton National Park, and you make it to winter range, and then you start to come in contact with some of the things that we need to have as humans. And some of those things are fences to help keep livestock in and contained. Some of those things are houses where we live. And so you start to to get into these situations where you're having to interact with things that you've never experienced, and you're learning how to navigate that as you go. And so as they come into winter range, that's where we've seen some human development and some human influences on the land. And so as that's another piece of the puzzle that you've got to navigate.
So mule deer in Wyoming have been declining, but the Upper Shoshone herd that we've been talking about, the one that goes from the Cody area into Yellowstone and back, they're doing okay, but it sounds like there are some indicators where that may not be the case in future years. What are you seeing as potential challenges for them going forward?
We are fortunate that we have seen our mule deer herd here with the Upper Shoshone. Those numbers actually increase over the last 7 to 8 years. What we've seen in this herd is an increase in chronic wasting disease rates from about 0 to 5% in 2017 to over 20% this last year. And so some of that, we're trying to understand why that is occurring. What we've seen in the Cody winter range is that development has caused that some of the fields to become more packed with mule deer because there's fewer and fewer large open spaces. And so what we see is that higher densities of those mule deer in those fields could be contributing to those higher chronic wasting disease rates. And if we continue, you know, development and kind of shrinking those open areas, we could see those mule deer being pushed into smaller and smaller areas in those portions of the winter range.
How can some of this data that you've been gathering help guide some of the future management decisions around mule deer in the Cody area?
We're very fortunate here. I would say of any place in the state, we've got the information, the data we need to make smart decisions moving forward, especially when it comes to, you know, where development could have the least or most amount of impact on mule deer. We've seen from recent research that mule deer, there is a threshold with which mule deer kind of go away from or move away from that development. And so we know kind of areas where mule deer are using right now, and we know what that looks like. And if we overlay that with kind of some of the future planning, we can make some wise decisions. We can make smart decisions on how we develop. One of the things that draws people to this area are wildlife and wild places. And that's really what I think is a huge draw for folks here in the Cody area is a closeness to the wilderness, to the wildness of what mule deer really represent. And so I think that if given the information and the data and, you know, sitting down and trying to plan in a way that allows for both to occur, we can do that here. And I think we can be a proving ground for that for other places, not only in Wyoming, but across the West.
That was Wyoming Game and Fish wildlife biologist and mule deer biographer Tony Mong speaking with Wyoming Public Radio's Olivia Wheats. A new book argues it's time to rethink what it means to be rural. That's next on Open Spaces.
Hello, Human Nature listeners. This is Megan Feary, the host of the show, here to tell you that a brand new season is coming your way March 5th. You'll hear the story of a woman who befriended a wild fox, an interview with an author about the incredible plants and animals that only come alive at night, and a man who went in search of Bigfoot.
I was thinking that I was doing something wrong. This is just crazy. You can't have a relationship with a fox.
I do also think that we associate darkness with death. And so to start exploring and appreciating night and darkness as a state full of life, it's really impactful.
The little boat was, you know, getting farther and farther away. And I was just standing here alone. And I looked around and realized that there's no one on these islands.
So make sure you're subscribed to Human Nature on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. When you think about the main street in your hometown, or your parents' hometown, about why it's now all boarded up, or why your classmates all moved away. What are your assumptions? Maybe that it was inevitable, or that people didn't try hard enough to save it? A new book called Reviving Rural America, Towards Policies of Resilience, argues those assumptions are based on old mythologies of ruralness. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards spoke with the author, Annie Eisenberg, about how to replace those myths with a modern vision for the future of rural America.
Yeah, I first started thinking about kind of narratives and myth versus fact during those first 2 years I did in West Virginia from 2014 to 2016, where I was just having some cognitive dissonance about my lived experience versus the things I would hear about West Virginia. Like, this was a region that I thought was beautiful and complex and interesting and very challenged. There was obviously a lot of poverty, issues with poisoned water, sickness. And then I would go outside the region and people would make distasteful jokes about it. And that was really, really troubling to me. So that's where I wanted to sort of understand the mythology of place. When you start pulling the thread on sort of rural stereotypes, we all know them, right? And so I think that that ends up factoring into political conversations in important ways. And then I got interested in sort of myths about the economy and how they all sort of interact together to paint a really negative picture of like a dead, old, useless place. You know, when we're talking about millions of people who provide the nation's food and energy, right? So there was a lot to work with there.
I found it fascinating reading your book about how that then leads to ways in which the economy that you just mentioned, you know, we end up finding that natural resources are kind of funneled out, and then that feeds an urban wealth. Can you talk a little bit about that relationship there?
That's been sort of part of what's fascinating and makes all of this all the more complicated, is you have an increasingly urbanized society. And that majority urban and suburban population then does have this tendency to kind of look down on the rural population, while at the same time deriving and extracting all of these values and benefits. So it's easy for stereotypes to take hold instead of firsthand knowledge, right? It's been very normalized that we have distant, invisible places that get depleted, but if you're someone who doesn't really have to look at it, it seems natural. The first piece of that is trying to persuade the majority of the country that it is worth doing more to fix.
Yeah, we have sort of these assumptions, and not yet another one of those stereotypes is sort of this idea that rural depopulation is just something that happens naturally. Can you explore that in some more detail?
It gets wrapped up in this narrative of, well, yeah, modernity is urban. When you become modern, when there's progress, everyone moves to a city. But you're always going to have somebody who we, you know, call left behind to produce the food and the energy or whatever other goods require working with raw materials. And then there's also this question of like, what happens when a place depopulates, the way our society has sort of failed to intervene, when the rug gets pulled out of a small town when a plant closes or something like that. I don't think that's normal. I don't think we should say like this was anything other than a tragedy.
Maybe we can explore some of the myths more specifically. I'm really interested in why you feel like there's a myth about rural empowerment. That one was kind of a surprise.
I tend to start with the premise when I'm talking about rural economic challenges that I am talking about a disadvantaged class. But the response that I often get is, but they have so much more voting power. You know, rural places or red states get so much more federal funds. So you get this image of kind of a powerful taker class instead of how I think of them as, on average, I believe there is a class-based disadvantage of rurality. In my mind, whatever power rural populations get from our electoral systems isn't bearing fruit for improving the material conditions of rural populations. we get a disservice in the form of the election maps that you see on election night, where it's just like red, 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 or blue, blue, blue. And I think that really sort of warps the actual realities on the ground.
What you end up kind of exploring towards the end of your book is an idea to reconceptualize rural America as a commons. I wonder if you can kind of define what you mean by that and explore how that could work.
You know, conversations on renewable energy right now. We, the urban majority, are entitled to be putting utility scale solar and wind farms on rural land right now. So there's a sense of sort of urban entitlement to rural resources. Okay, let's assume that's true. There are these sort of shared or stacked sets of entitlements where it's like, well, local folks have a claim to a resource, but also we're saying the national public has a claim to a resource. Okay, we have governance schemes and sort of theories and literature on how to govern common goods or things called commons, right? But the one point I really wanted to make was, well, if it's a shared resource, then we as a society have to take care of it. And I think that's where the sort of grand 20th century failure has come in, is if rural America holistically is a valuable resource in and of itself, which I think it really is, then we as a society have an obligation to steward it and do a better job of sort of governing it at these multiple levels of stakeholder and involvement. No matter how you slice it, the divide between places is artificial and we're all in it together. And if flooding's happening here, it's going to affect people downstream, metaphorically and literally. I think the whole us versus them thing needs to go, right? Because our fates are really interconnected, no matter how you look at it.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards speaking with Annie Eisenberg, author of Reviving Rural America, Towards Policies of Resilience. Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. The entire show and all the stories you heard here can be found on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org. You can also find our stories wherever you get podcasts and on the station's social media platforms. Thanks to Melody Edwards, our audio producer this week, Ivy Engel, our digital producer, and Cody Hume, our social media manager. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.